we're going to hearing a work. We're going to open with a work session on House Bill 5025, Government Standards and Practices Commission, and with that, we'll open the work session on 5025, House Bill 5025. And Mr. Rocco has some words for us and some comments and recommendations as far as the Legislative Fiscal Office is concerned. Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I provide you with a memo this morning. We had sent this out to you earlier in draft form, and there was only one minor change to the earlier version, which I will highlight for you when we get to it. There's three pieces to this. There's a memo with recommendations. There's a Orbitz report that details the recommendations. And then there's a two-page performance measure summary at the back. Basically, LFO's recommendations on Government Standards and Practices Commission is a general fund budget of $1,065,691 and $3,368 other funds dollars, six positions, and 5.79 FTE. As you can see from the table, the summary table, this is about a 63% increase in budget from 0507, and this is largely due to the additional needs that the agency has for office support, education and training, and some of the consequences of Senate Bill 10, which you heard a couple weeks ago, and we expect to bring back to you after receiving amendments probably by mid-next week. Going through the recommendation, package number 100, was requesting a permanent position, an office assistant two, to provide additional office support within the agency, and a reclass of an existing executive support specialist two position to a compliance specialist one classification. LFO's recommendation is to modify this slightly on the reclassification after talking with the new executive director, who came into his position after the budget was developed by the previous director, reviewed the reclass and felt that it was better classified as a program analyst one rather than an executive support specialist two. Took that request through the Department of Administrative Services approval process, and it was approved. So we're recommending the reclass B, Program Analyst 1, rather than Executive Support Specialist 2. The only change that we made to the package was a slight reduction in the personal services for the OPE. This represents 6 months of the PERS cost for the new position, the new Office Assistant 2 position.
Mr. Chair, from San Carlos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ken, we're actually talking about two positions here. Am I following, or did I get lost? Because all of a sudden you were talking about executive support and program analyst, and I was still on the office assistant. So those are two different positions. Am I correct in that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, yes. There is the addition of one permanent new position. That would be the office assistants two.
Okay.
And also in that package, which is rather complicated and probably shouldn't be done that way, there is also a reclass of an existing position.
Okay, I just want to make sure I was following correctly. Thank you. Can I ask a follow-up question, Mr. Chair? Thank you. How is this going? Because I see that with regards to the, and it appears to be with regards to the position of the office assistant two, how is this going to help with key performance measure number 5, which is reducing, in their goals here, is reducing the number of days for written opinions of advice. And I assume that that's whenever a question is posed by a public official or a lobbyist about whatever, and they're going to research it and then issue a written opinion about that advice. how does that, am I following that correctly, Ken, that that's the position tied to KPM number 5?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cromwell, I believe yes, because the position will help relieve the duties of the reclass program analyst one position from having to do a lot of the doing two things, processing
the actual clerical work.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so that's why the KPM number 5, the target was improved to reflect that additional time that would be available to process paperwork through the process.
Okay, thank you.
Package 101 was a request for a training and development specialist position to provide education and training services that are required under law and currently only provided by the executive director. The LFO recommended modification to this there are two changes to this basically. One is, again, this position was identified as a training and development specialist, one in the governor's recommended budget. And again, the new director reviewed that classification and felt that a program analyst one classification would give the position a little more flexibility so that it could also do additional tasks besides just purely training. And I think you heard during the director's earlier testimony that they do have a plan on developing a sort of an online training type system, and this program analyst one would be a better suited classification for doing that kind of work. The other recommended change is to reflect the effective date of the position. As we'll get to, the agency is going to be required to move. Currently in their current location, they do not have room for an additional training position of this nature. So what we're recommending is to reduce the FTE by a couple months, by 3 months, so it would start October 1st, 2007 to allow for adequate time for them to move and recruit for the position. Those numbers are reflected in the $17,308 reduction to the package to reflect that three-month change in the position.
Ken,
Mr. Chair.
Oh. Go ahead, Chair.
Thank you, Mr.
Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ken, my assumption then from what you said is that this position will roll up to a full FTE in the 09-11 biennium?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cromwell, yes, this would be a full-time permanent position, so it would roll up to a full FTE.
And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
And do we have a guesstimate of what that increased cost then would be from this from the 07-09 biennium to the 09-11 biennium?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cromwell, it would be roughly equivalent to what we're reducing now, and then there would be the normal position increases after a position's been there for 2 years. So it would have step increases the next time, and whatever salary adjustments are agreed upon with the executive branch and the bargaining units. So.
Okay.
And that would be automatically built into the budget request next time, because the personnel data system would automatically increase that to 1.0 FTE for 09-11.
Okay. Thank you.
Ken, on this, should 101 also be tied to, or should this be related to KPM 7, which is satisfaction of the training? I mean, simply increasing the amount of training doesn't do me any doesn't do anything for my satisfaction of the whole thing, unless it is tied to the effectiveness of the training in some way.
Mr. Chair, I think you're absolutely correct that would be tied to satisfaction of training for the institution.
Thank you.
May I ask another question, Mr. Chair? Thank you. With regards to the relationship of this position to KPM number 6, and I see that the target for 2008 is 75 and the target for 2009 is 100, so that's a 33% increase. My question is that 75 different sessions, or does that include the 100 different sessions, does that include the potential online presentations that that the department may or may not have control over when a person accesses?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I think as the director testified earlier, he has some issues with that performance measure to begin with, because the pure number of presentations provided doesn't really, it's not an outcome-based type measure. And I think when we get to performance measures, the recommendation is going to be to basically have the agency review all of these and come back with better ones in the interim.
Okay.
But I think increasing the plan, as I understand it, you may want to ask the director this himself. The plan, as I understand it, is not to be traveling around the state constantly making in-person presentations, but to set something up. And I'm thinking that this number would reflect some of that online type interaction. But you may want to ask Mr. Burson that.
Bailey, Mr. Chair.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, Ron Burson, Executive Director for Government Standards and Practices Commission. And what Mr. Rockowitz said is correct. I mean, again, going back to these performance measures, I think I testified during the public hearing that I'm not overly exuberant about these performance measures, and actually had asked the committee to give me a chance to come back in the interim with better performance measures. But the idea behind these targets was that this position would increase the number of training exposures that were out there, whether that was in person or if that was online or if that was some other way of getting training to individuals that need that. And it didn't necessarily mean actually, say, getting in a car and driving or increasing the number of miles we put on. But, I envision that this person should be able to increase the number of people that are exposed to the commission's training.
And are you thinking about, are you planning, are you looking at some televideo or whatever the terminology is for this? I mean, you have a number of places throughout the state that you can go with this medium. Mm-hmm. and reach a lot of different people potentially at the same time and still have it interactive with the trainer as such. And is that entering into your thinking with it, or and if so, could I simply suggest that it does or should be brought into your planning and thinking with that, because it's not a terribly efficient thing to put somebody in an automobile and drive them to Pendleton for three people for a training session, man. Nor is it efficient to put some three people in an automobile and drive them to here when we can reach a whole bunch of them by another medium in a reasonably successful way, as has been demonstrated by the colleges and universities here in the state. So is that in the thinking, or where are you at with that?
Chair Jensen, that particular idea had not come before me, or I had not thought of that particular idea of the teleconferencing, but yeah. We've been kind of talking about different ideas. I mean, the base model that my vision had was that it would be a web-based type of system where somebody from any part of the state could actually go to our website at oregon.gov/GSPC and pull up a particular type of train that they're looking for, either conflicts of interest, some type of new employee orientation that included not being able to benefit as a public official, maybe even just training on what is a public official. I think there's a lot of confusion on who is a public official. I mean, I understand the members understand they are, but I'm not too sure that the volunteer down at the schoolyard thinks that they're a public official. So, but that's a great idea. I mean, we're looking for lots of ways of reaching a lot of different people. And I think it's important to point out, though, on these trips or getting into cars and going to see people, there still is a reason to do that. There's different associations. An example is the city attorneys had asked me to come and speak to them, and the city attorneys are going to be important for me on whatever passes through the building this year, on getting that word out to all the city council members and all the planning commissions throughout the state, because they're the people that are advising those members of those commissions. So I still believe there's a need for going to some of these, but you're right, you can't do it for three people, but you have to weigh each one. But it's really going to be an exciting time, and I really envision coming back before this committee. And I know earlier when I testified, Senator Johnson had said, giving that kind of trust me type of feeling out here, but I envision coming back to this committee with a program that's, instead of just looking at the number of presentations that we're giving, and that doesn't tie into the number of people or the number of satisfied people that are out there, but a target that shows the number of public officials that have been reached, and we've reached them in several different ways.
Representative Cromwell and Representative Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would also think that, and I agree with you, just saying this number of presentations, it really isn't kind of an outcome, but one of the things that you could potentially measure on your outcomes is what is the, does the training have an effect on the number of complaints that the agency receives regarding city council members or school board members or school district superintendents or however they're classified? But is there a demonstrable difference in the number of complaints that are received because of the training that these people have been able to get, whether it's online or through their associations? I would imagine that just trying to get to OSBA and COSA and League of Oregon Cities and Associated Oregon Counties and all of their different subgroups that you might work with, that by itself could probably keep a person busy for a full year.
For a while.
Very similar. I guess what struck me is there really isn't any anything in these measures that actually track the number of complaints and whether they go up and down or what would affect them. So I thought that may be missing.
Thank you, Representative.
Good point.
Okay, Ken.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members, on top of page 3, the next package is package 102. This was a package, basically it was a placeholder of $10,000 general fund for funding to study whether the development of an electronic filing system for GSPC documents was something that should be done. Senate Bill 10, as you heard a couple weeks ago, actually requires the establishment of that system, and the co-chair budget has set aside money towards the development of that system. The agency is working through the Department of Administrative Services to get a rough idea and a time schedule together on this development of the system, which they expect to report back to the committee in the February session on. Based on that, LFO's recommendation is to deny this package simply because the money is being provided elsewhere to actually implement the electronic system. Package 806 these are LFO.
Mr. Chair, can we go back to thank you, Mr. Chair. Can we go back to 102 for just a second?
For a second. Sure.
I'm concerned that Senate Bill 10 is requiring the establishment of an electronic filing system, but do we know yet whether or not There is a product out there that can be set up to do what it is that we're wanting to do, or are we just sort of going on faith here, and then are we going to be facing, you know, in February or sometime during the e-board, you know, the agency coming in with a, you know, $18 million request because they have to write the code and buy the hardware and do all of this other stuff to meet what's in this bill. I guess I'm a little concerned about how that's going to flesh out. I don't have necessarily a problem with denying the request here, but I'm just concerned about what the overall effect is going to be on a roll-up of the agency budget in the future, but also what it's going to do with us putting that kind of requirement on, not sort of knowing where it's going.
Would that question be better saved for Senate Bill 10 when we get it here?
I guess it might.
I think it's a really good question, and one we need to look at and address. But I think I would kind of prefer that we, if I can trust your memory to bring it back. Otherwise, I'll have to write it down.
If I can trust my memory, okay, bring it back. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, we'll certainly bring that up with Senate Bill 10 because it is probably one of the primary cost component of that bill, so we will talk about that. And, okay. And there are, just to give you a rough idea, the Secretary of State system, we checked with them to see the new filing system they just developed, and I think the cost of that was somewhere in the $1.5 million range. And we're just not sure if this system, it needs to be as complicated as that. So that's why the co-chairs have currently set aside about $700,000 towards the development of the system. But we're looking into your questions. But we will get to that in Senate Bill 10.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Package 806 is the LFO's recommending the addition of an investigator position. Actually, it's termed a compliance specialist one. And this is also associated with Senate Bill 10 that requires additional investigative work of the agency. Currently, the agency only has one investigator position. And so with the additional reporting requirements under Senate Bill 10, we're recommending the addition of a position. This position would be have an effective date of September 1st, again, to allow time for relocation and recruitment. And so, again, this is a 0.92 FTE in the 07-09 biennium, but will roll up to 1.0 FTE in the 09-11. And the cost of that position is estimated at $105,567 general fund.
Ken, it's my assumption that if Senate Bill 10 meets with runs into some rough waters and fails to get through, that this position is unfunded then?
Mr. Chair, if the Senate Bill 10 does not go through, we can remove this position in an end of session bill to remove authority for it.
Yes. Thank you.
Package 807 is another LFO adjustment, recommended adjustment to the budget. As we've been talking, the agency is currently has very limited space in its current office, and we're expecting them to have to move with the additional positions, even with even under the governor's recommended budget. I believe they would have had to move, and these costs were not included in the governor's recommended budget. The agency's done some checking with available space in the area, and feels that they need to get some money for remodeling of the space that is available. So this package is about $61,470 of general fund for additional rent costs that they'll have because they will also have some common space that they will be that they don't have now, such as a conference room. Right now, the commission has to meet off-site because there is no space in their current office for a conference room. There's some remodeling expenses, furniture, which is basically a conference room table and chairs for the commission, and then moving costs to actually move their existing employees and equipment and hook up telephones and things like that from their current location to the new location. So we're recommending $61,470 general fund for that. In addition, a number of these costs, of course, outside of the additional rent, are one-time costs. So we're recommending that, and the moving costs have just been estimated at this point, especially the remodeling costs. So we're recommending that the agency be directed to report to budget management and LFO on the actual costs of the relocation, and then any money that's not needed for that relocation be unscheduled at that time, and then in February the committee can consider whether it should be used towards the electronic filing system or just be taken back and put back into the general fund. Item number three on page four, this is LFO's recommendation on the establishment of a $700,000 special purpose appropriation to the emergency board for the agency for costs associated with the development of the electronic filing system required in Senate Bill 10. This will not appear in this bill, in House Bill 5025. It will appear in the emergency fund bill, budget bill, which is Senate Bill 5509, as a special purpose appropriation. And again, the $700,000 is just an estimate at this time, and if we get more information from preliminary work that's being done right now by the end of session, we can adjust that number appropriately. And then item number four is the recommendation for the budget bill amendment, which is to delete the $927,210 general fund that's currently in 5025 and replace it with the $1,065,691,000. And then,
Senator Fletcher. Just to ask one question for Mr. Rockwell, but is $18,000 for a conference room? It's $1,560 a month for a conference room. And rent a pretty nice three-bedroom home for, that's for 2 years, isn't it?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Witz, it is for 2 years, and it's not just the conference room. It's also they are going to have additional staff people, and there's other, the configuration of the space is just a little larger than what they have now. So
the rest of their offices will be too?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Finally, Mr. Chair and members, item five is the performance measure recommendation. If you want to jump to the last page of your handout, our recommendation on the performance measures are to temporarily make some changes to item numbers 1, 3, and 5, and this is just the addition of the word average in the description of the measure. It used to say number of days, and it's really just the average number of days, so it's a very simple technical change. The targets have been adjusted to reflect the additional positions. We're recommending that the agency be directed to conduct the customer service measure that was supposed to have been done in 05-07, but I don't believe they actually did conduct it because of staff limitations. They just didn't have enough time to do it. We're recommending, though, that they do that as early as possible for the next biennium, and that they add the KPM 10, which is the board and commission governance best practices measure, as a new measure. But then in addition to all that, we're recommending that the committee direct them to review all of their key performance measures during the interim and report back to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee for approval of revised and or new measures that are more outcome-oriented and deal with some of the things that the committee has already discussed today.
That's it,
Mr. Chair.
I would entertain a motion to accept the LFO recommendations on performance measures.
Mr. Chair, I move that we accept the LFO performance measures. And if you'd be so inclined, considering the size of this budget being relatively small, would you accept a motion for the entire package if I were to put it together for you real quick?
Well, I would accept that, yeah.
Assuming there's no disagreement amongst the committee.
Okay.
I'd move House Bill 5025 with recommendations by LFO and including approval of key performance measures to full ways and means with a due pass recommendation.
You've heard the motion from Senator Bates. To is there discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Are you up for proxy?
Yes.
Do I have to have a carrier for this? This is a like a house bill.
We need a carrier in full ways and means.
Yeah, we need a full ways
house
and
bill,
means.
So
I will carry it in the full ways and means. And I would ask Senator Bates if he would like to carry it on the Senate floor. And I'd be happy to carry it on the House floor, but I'd ask Representative Crummell if he would like to carry it on the House floor.
Sure, Mr. Chair. I'll carry it on the House floor.
That cover our agenda, isn't it? Thank you, Ken. At that, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 5025, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1033. And we have Adrian Sexton with us this morning to keep us on track and inform us what the Senate Bill 1033 is all about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. There apparently are no sign-ups for public discussion, so I'll outline for you what Senate Bill 1033 is. I provided information to you by email a couple of days ago. It included an attachment, and I've given you a hard copy here today, of a review of the Oregon Fiscal Impact Statement process that LFO conducted last interim. We looked at a lot of statistics. We looked at what the statutes require. We also explored what other states do, concluded that other states don't have an equivalent process to ours, and so we went off on our own to examine what we could make recommendations on for trying to improve the fiscal impact process within Oregon. So that was the impetus for Senate Bill 1033, which recognizes that the current statutory requirement for fiscal impact statements is very specific to those bills that affect local governments, the public employee retirement system, and public safety. They specify that we will produce a fiscal impact statement, on every measure that has an effect on those policy areas. As you know, there are lots of bills introduced, and a lot of bills don't go anywhere. The volume of workloads is such that the fiscal office has prioritized in the past the bills that are reported out of committee, because the House and Senate rules do require that fiscal statements be and revenue statements be part of the documentation that's delivered to the desks when bills are reported out of committee. So that's our top priority. Second, bills that have been scheduled for a work session only, we do our best to get impact statements to committees for that. But as you all know from sitting on policy committees, sometimes amendments come at the last minute. Literally, the morning of a morning meeting or the afternoon of an afternoon meeting. It's generally not feasible for us to meet that requirement or that expectation. We would prefer that we could do that, but some of the dynamics of the committee processes are such that it's often not feasible. Our next priority is public hearing and work session. If the bills are somewhat straightforward, we might be able to get those out. Our last priority is for public hearing only. And that was unfortunate because the outcomes of the survey that we did during this review indicated the members would really like to have the impact statements for public hearing. Sometimes that can give the policy committees the opportunity to see the nature of the fiscal effect on a bill before they actually get started, and then they can start vetting the bill, analyzing the policy, and making a determination of what policy direction they'd like to go. So we are a little conflicted with what the legislature would prefer and what we have the capacity to actually produce. We do suggest in the review document that if it became a priority of the legislature to have fiscal statements for public hearings, we would have to take a look at how we do those, that they may not be the fully documented series of analyses that we currently do for bills as they're reported out. Maybe take a higher level view, identify the affected agencies, perhaps the nature of what the fiscal impact would stem from, but not necessarily get into dollars and cents. So the office will continue to look at how we can comply or comport to what the legislature would prefer. And as you know, with the potential for the retimed sessions, LFO believes that a lot of procedural issues will need to be evaluated to make sure that we can all meet those requirements and expectations. The bill does include the Legislative Revenue Office requirements for a revenue statement. Paul Warner was part of the discussion in developing this particular measure and is supportive of the change because, again, they do not necessarily issue a revenue statement on every measure until it's reported out. And that is what the measure does.
Questions?
Another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, does this bill then, I guess in a couple of my committees, there have been policy bills moving through that the committee chair, once they found out that it was going to have a really substantial fiscal, was able to change it in a policy, from a policy perspective, before it got reported out of committee, so that it didn't go to Ways and Means and die. And so I guess would at least maybe a committee chair still have that leeway to request a fiscal? Or, I mean, having never chaired a committee myself, I'm not real clear on what the relationship between the committee chairs and legislative fiscal office is in getting these statements. But I guess that would be my one concern if we move to a place where it's just impact statements on bills reported out of committee. Sometimes it's too late then.
Mr. Chair and Representative Edwards, I understand your concern. And again, the statute, we're trying to align with what the minimum requirement is, if you will, or for purposes of floor deliberation. To the extent that committee chairs work with interested parties, stakeholders, agencies, local governments, to reduce the fiscal nature of a bill, there are two-pronged concerns from legislative fiscal office standpoint. One is, are we going to be rendered redundant in the fiscal impact process if they're working very closely with state agencies or other parties to reduce the fiscal effect, when we may find that once we receive that send amendments to the bill and get information from the agencies and others, that we have a different interpretation, that maybe we believe that the agency can't absorb what that one bill does because we have other information or another approach. So what I think experienced this session and in prior sessions is that that dynamic goes on in the background. And then they develop a set of amendments, which LFO then receives after the committee has taken action on it in some cases. And assuming that there is no fiscal, and then we write something contrary. So that's one of those fine points that it would be very helpful if the Legislative Fiscal Office was kept more in that discussion loop. But the reality is, and I have some statistics here, that the workload during that timeline of when bills are being moved out of committee, we issued almost 30% of all fiscal statements issued to date in a 30-day period in April. That's a lot of bills being moved. And the capacity to do a reasonable, accurate, objective analysis is a challenge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there's also, sort of tagging on to Representative Edwards here, I think there's also an underlying political side to this, that we shouldn't necessarily get lost. And that is the dynamic, you know, we all come in, all 90 of us come in with all these brilliant ideas of bills that we have, of things that need to be done because a constituent's brought something to our attention, or we just think it's a good idea, or whatever the case may be. And in many cases, an agency looks at a bill, and if they decide that they don't like the bill, or they don't want to do what the bill is suggesting that they would need to do, they have no problem. The agency heads have no problem coming in with a very large fiscal impact because they know that that'll basically kill it. One of the things, though, that I've been trying to work with some of our agencies on is that when they have, and you know, this is the type of leadership that can only start at the top. And if the governor's not interested, then I guess it doesn't really make a lot of difference. But and that is that agencies, when they see a bill that they have concerns about, whether it's a big cost or it's just something that they don't like or they don't want to have to do or whatever the case may be, but they have concerns about something. What I've been trying to encourage the agencies to do is, number one, go and talk to the sponsor of the bill and find out where it is that the sponsor is trying to go and what problem it is that they're trying to solve, and you know, all of those sorts of things. And to actually have an open dialogue between the executive branch and the legislative branch, which I know is kind of a novel idea, but anyway, if we can have that. And then for them to be able to work together to get wherever it is that the sponsor of the bill is trying to get to, and maybe that reduces the cost. I think then the sponsor or the committee chair, either one, I think can, you know, off the record call Legislative Fiscal and say, do you have other information that we maybe aren't aware of, without Legislative Fiscal having to do a full-blown fiscal analysis on. And that way the chair and the sponsor potentially have more information that they can deal with, and whether or not they're going to be able to get to where they need to go or want to go without a huge impact on the fiscal abilities of the state. But at the same time, I can certainly, having been a committee chair, I can certainly appreciate what LFO goes through when every bill is introduced. They're trying to roll through and see if there's any kind of fiscal impact and trying to do an analysis on. And about a third of the bills that are introduced are actually going to make it through the process. And so from a standpoint, it makes a lot of sense to have you guys doing the analysis, the full analysis on a bill after it's actually come out of committee. I guess is where I'm trying to get to, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Excuse me just a second, but Senator Burkhard Krummler, if I'm reading this correctly, this is a joint, this is sponsored by the Joint Ways and Means Committee at the request of JLAC.
Yes.
And therefore, I assume that you chaired that.
Yes, so Mr. Chair. I was the co-chair of that, and I have to admit that my short-term memory was kind of escaping me until I started reading some of the other material and realized that I had seen it before. But yes, we did in our November meeting, we did look at this issue, and it was something that Dallas had brought to us, Dallas and Ken had both brought to us from a standpoint of the amount of work that legislative fiscal is required to do prior to bills ever even getting a hearing. And this seemed like a very good approach from a systemic standpoint of relieving some of the issues that they have. But it doesn't necessarily mean that I don't think that a committee chair wouldn't still be able to call LFO and do some things in the background off the record and that sort of thing.
Yeah, my experience with LFO as a chair, committee chair, is that if you go to them, they're very helpful, or they'll do everything they can to help you.
Yes.
With it. But Senator Bates.
Yeah, I share Representative Edwards' concerns about this. To ask a committee when they're hearing a bill, or more importantly when they're in a work session, to make a decision of moving that bill and not knowing fiscal impact, to me is really not the direction we want to be going. And I think this whole thing drives to the point that we have inadequately staffed LFO, as we've been inadequately staffed LC, and we're trying to fix the system by relieving the pressure on it by lowering our standards. And I don't think that's the right direction to go. I would think that sitting in a work session in a policy commission and not knowing the fiscal impact of the bill you're discussing is inappropriate to be asked to take a vote on. Those bills would obviously be going into the Ways and Means Committee, and at that point another group of legislators would make a decision on it. But it doesn't allow the policy committee to make changes to the bill, as you pointed out appropriately, that might be helpful. It's all done with the chair trying to get as much information out of LFO as it can, and I'm not faulting LFO on this. Okay. And I have a real difficulty voting for this because of that. I think we're moving in the wrong direction. Instead of doing what we should do, is beefing up LFO, giving them the funds and the people they need to get their job done, we're just releasing some pressure by moving in the wrong direction, from my point of view. There's other things we could have done with this. We could have said you have to pre-file so LFO has a chance prior to coming in here in the you know, the March and April part of the session when everything is flowing so quickly that they can't possibly reply to everything, and limit the number of bills. We could say that as at the level of when the bill is going to a work session, but not just a hearing, that we need a physical impact statement at that point. There's other ways around this, but I'm just concerned that the people who make the first decision on moving a bill forward through a committee are doing so to a certain degree with some blinders on. And that's not a reflection of LFO. Don't get me wrong here. Okay, LFO does a great job, but I'm not sure they've got the enough staff to make this job happen the way we want it to.
Senator Bates, could I ask you and Representative Galizia to step out and Representative Galizia's private office and see how much money he's got that he can give us to do what you're recommending?
Mr. Chair, I can tell you I got none.
Oh. I've got 10 bucks in my back pocket, right?
Yeah. Okay. And seriously, Senator, you know, I was going to make the statement that this is all easily solvable if the legislature has the will to put the resources necessary in the legislative fiscal office to provide for, you know, at least right now, like 24, 48-hour turnaround on some of this material as it comes up. And I appreciate, as I know you do, the difficulty of getting there with that. Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair. I struggled with this during JLAC under this concept because for the same reasons just articulated by Senator Bates, I think we're going the wrong direction. I think we need more information to make decisions, not less information. And I understand the futility, I believe, of doing fiscal reports on bills that have no chance of ever moving anywhere. But there should be some manner that the policy committees could have a fiscal report before they have to make a decision on a bill. It just doesn't make sense to me. I have struggled with it also.
Firebase again.
Could I ask that in JLAC, was there a discussion of that you didn't ask for a physical on a bill until it was actually going to a work session? A work session was scheduled. I mean, when you get to work session, there's a high likelihood that bill is going somewhere. Yeah, obviously a lot of public testimony just is never gets you there, but I would think that once you get to work session, you've got a bill that's probably going somewhere, has a higher probability of going clear through the process. I don't know the numbers on that. Was there a discussion of that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bates, there was some discussion about that, and there was some discussion, if I remember correctly, also about the prioritization that Adrian was just talking about, and one of the reasons why, you know, they currently prioritize the bill that's scheduled for a work session obviously rises to a much higher level in terms of getting it getting the work done. The problem is, as we I appreciate your suggestions from the standpoint of members pre-session filing, and I think we need to make sure that, you know, we have good understanding between the chief clerk's office or the Senate secretary's office in terms of what happens when, you know, when we can actually pre-session file and all of those sorts of things. I really appreciate that. But I think that as we get down to, and especially towards the middle and end of session, when a committee chair says, you know, we're going to schedule this work session tomorrow, or we're going to schedule it on Wednesday, and it's a Monday type of thing, and things start moving a little faster, and LFO is trying to keep up with that crush. And again, recognizing that about 30% of the bills that are ever sponsored and actually introduced are actually ever going to go somewhere. So how do we get to that sort of that hybrid, I guess, becomes a real question. And maybe, you know, maybe one of the things is that as committee chairs are making decisions about bills that they want to seriously consider being able to share that information confidentially with, because I understand too, committee chairs don't necessarily always want to show their hand, and so, but being able to share that information confidentially with LFO so that they can get the information that they need and have it in hand ready when they're Senator Representative Edwards and then Representative Colizio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with the sentiment about LFO staffing or having the resources, and I guess it's a question for LFO, though, now to, you know, advocate for them. Is there, I mean, when you have such a peak demand at one time, I mean, is there any amount of staff that, I mean, if we staff them up to be able to do their job on time to our standards that we would like to see, reviewing all bills, it seems like the we'd have LFO staffers all over the place, you know, in order to have enough, and then many of those people may be unused the rest of the year. I mean, it seems like that's a really peak time. So I mean, I have sympathy with LFO on this issue, and that's why I kind of interjected the concept of working with the committee chairs into this discussion, because the committee chair knows if they're going to be moving a bill to a work session or not. And, you know, it is a waste of resources to be requiring fiscal impact statements on things that just are never, I mean, they're not even going to be scheduled for public hearing. And so, I mean, I have a lot of sympathy with LFO there as well, but I'm not totally comfortable with going to taking the impact statements out altogether. So,
Representative Blasio.
The people of Oregon should be thankful that most of the bills don't make it. Ms. Sexton, I guess what you had said before, and I don't know that I caught it exactly, but the material effect of this bill doesn't say that there will be no fiscal impact statements prior to it being reported out of committee. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Galizio, that's correct. It would statutorily require them on measures reported out. That does not change the internal policies of the Legislative Fiscal Office to attempt to achieve the rest of what the legislature would like to have, and that is information at the table when you're making the policy decision for the final time. I would be happy to have personal conversations on some of the underlying issues, such as receiving 7 amendments within a 24-hour period in advance of a work session. That's when there's simply no way to determine, even from the committee staff level, which of those amendments may actually be considered. So that's when we say, all right, just keep sending us amendments for our information so we know the level of activity that's out there. We may look at what the general nature of those amendments are, but we're not going to be producing fiscal statements on last-minute arrivals.
Can I just follow up?
Follow up.
So the material effect of this bill, again, in other words, this would provide LFO with a bit more flexibility. And there, the situation where there was a bill that perhaps the committee chair, or it seemed that there was a decent chance, or there was a real perceived need to find out the fiscal, I mean, that could still happen under this bill, right?
Mr. Chair and Representative Galizio, of course.
Okay. Thank you.
I was going to ask just about the same question. We'll make it clear. Is the net effect of this bill that it would allow LFO to actually, in situations where you actually are working a bill, you have a work session, when it will free up time, you'd actually have a better chance of getting information to that committee than you do now, because you're not looking at every single bill that was introduced, and you could focus on the bills that were more likely to go through the process, more likely to have a work session.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bates, that's true. You may recall from the report, in the past, I have been the one person over the last couple of biennia to literally read every bill that was introduced. Now, sometimes it was fun. But after 6 hours a day of trying to make that initial determination of whether, of first of all, which agencies, if any, or local government units might be affected by the bill, and then to make an estimation of whether it might or might not. After doing this report and determining that, yes, 30% of the bills never go anywhere and some only get public hearings, this was when the audit committee considered requesting Senate Bill 1033. Once again, simply setting the least common denominator, if you will, when LFO has to produce impact statements for these 3 categories of bills. Now, we still do fiscal impact statements on bills that don't affect local government and bills that don't affect PERS and don't affect public safety. We have to do them on every bill that affects any jurisdiction once it's reported out. And again, that's the minimum. We try to do more, but that's what has to happen because House and Senate rules require them.
Okay. It strikes me I appreciate all of the discussion on this, but it strikes me that one of the places where the real responsibility is with the legislature itself. We could devote more resources there to do some of the things that we're talking about. B, we could take a more realistic sometimes approach as far as the bills that are introduced. Require returning members to pre-session file bills so that place a limit on the number of bills that they can file after the session opens. And we can even allow some pre-session filing as far as new members are concerned, since they are elected in the 1st of November and have until January to get their ideas in, perhaps all of them. We could put a little more emphasis on the pre-session filing. We could put more emphasis on reducing the number of bills that each legislator is allowed. I mean, I have seen over the past six sessions that I've been here that some legislators seem to think their relative worth is measured by the number of bills they introduce. I think that probably and sometimes even affects all of us. That, you know, we feel good if we've got some bills introduced. But I think we can do some things to ease up the load and make the thing easier there. It simply takes the will on our part to address those issues up front. And I think those things could be done in the House and Senate rules if we develop them at the beginning of each session that would provide some more reality checks to that. So I'm inclined to be sympathetic with the LFO with this. Senator Whitson.
I agree with just about everything you said. The one thing that I would wonder about is if constitutionally, someone who has been elected but has not yet been sworn in as a legislator can file a bill, because those of us who have been elected fairly recently remember being told very succinctly that thou shalt not represent yourself in any way as a representative or a senator until you have in fact been sworn in. We weren't even allowed to get a letterhead stationery printed or anything like that. So I would wonder, we'd have to check on that, I think.
Our memory has it, and I have trouble with short and long-term memory sometimes, memory has it that LFO took a couple of my pre-session filings after my first election when I hadn't been sworn in.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Time is growing short. Having heard the committee's discussion today, I move that 10-3.
Could I interrupt you just a moment and close the public hearing on House Bill or Senate Bill 1033 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1033?
Mr. Chair, before I make my motion, I would like to know what the physical impact of 10. No, I'm just kidding.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bates, has your desk is a no physical
thing. That's my favorite part of this whole
thing. Yeah, that's really the best. Anyway, having heard the discussion committee, I move that this is a bill worth moving forward and hoping it'll be one of those 30%ers to get through. I would have been happier had it been more prescriptive in stating about public hearings and work sessions being required to have physical statements, but I understand the good word of the LFO that will probably occur in any event. This may actually allow it to occur quicker and easier. So I would... Mr. Chair, with your permission, move Senate Bill 1033 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Discussion? Hearing none? Are there objections? Seeing no objections, so ordered. And we'll have the carrier on the House side, again, Representative Crummell, with his history in this particular area, be delighted to carry this bill there. And... Senator Whitson, would you carry on both full and Senate chamber?
Yep.
Thank you.
Does this have to go to Ways and Means first? Full Ways and Means?
I think so. Everything we do has to go to Full Ways and Means.
Let me amend my motion that it be sent to Full Ways and Means with due pass recommendation. My error.
The amendment is noted, and seeing no objections to it, we would adopt the amendment. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
And at this point, then, we close the work session on Senate Bill 1033 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2656. And the folks, I have folks that are signed up here to come forth on this, and I see nobody in the audience.
Do you want me to check the hall? Or?
If you want to.
Quick, let's pass it.
I don't think that was our... We're in public hearing here.
Okay. We can move quickly, though.
We'll give them a second here to see if they're still around. If they're not, we will...
I mean, it's complicated, so I don't like it, but we heard this a lot.
Yeah. Oh, we have been found. See, Mr. Barry is here. I see the good representative wants to have a word with us before the other folks come up. If you would, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I just wanted to come here and speak briefly to House Bill 2656. This bill was passed out of the Consumer Protection Committee and came after quite lengthy discussions and about 2.5 months or so of work groups trying to deal with some of the problems that we've had in construction claims in Oregon. Former Representative Gordon Anderson was also involved in this last session to some degree and stayed in contact with me as we were going through this. The Construction Claims Task Force came out with several recommendations, this being one of them. This is a version of one of them. They actually recommended that all people involved in installation of building envelopes be trained and certified. Our committee felt that that was not practical to train up the entire state of people, so we basically came down to making sure that one person on that job was trained in the installation and had substantial oversight over that installation process to make sure that these products that we're using today in the construction industry are being installed correctly. We had a lot of testimony over deck installations and penetrations and siding and all sorts of things that were being installed incorrectly and causing water intrusion and potentially mold down the road. So this version that was testified, even the industry came up and said this was one of the most important pieces of the construction claims recommendations. And we had a lot of other recommendations out there that we didn't adopt. One of them was creating a fund to pay people that had claims that didn't get covered. We had requiring a warranty. That bill got scaled back to we're just in a different bill where we're just asking people to offer a warranty on houses. It just seemed kind of odd that we have a world where you buy a new car for $25,000 and you can get a warranty with it. You buy a new house for $250,000 and you don't get a warranty. So we at least wanted the industry to offer a warranty. That was also a scaled back recommendation. But this particular recommendation, I think, is at the heart of one of the problems, is making sure that somebody on the construction projects knows what they're doing when they go to install these things. We decided to set up an advisory committee. Some people are maybe a little uncomfortable with that, but basically to look at the different programs and look at the different manufacturer installation presentations they do for products to potentially get them certified in different products. And we divided those products up into roofing, siding, and the stucco type of plaster type of products as well. I think this is a really important step for the industry and consumers. So I'll cut myself off at that.
I wasn't looking to cut yourself off. I was looking for to make sure that you had identified yourself, Representative.
Sorry, jumped right into it. It's a State Representative Paul Holvey, District 8.
Who has been testifying now for the last 34 seconds.
And also Chair of the House Consumer Protection Committee.
Thank you, Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Representative Holvey, you said in your testimony that there was someone on that job. And what I'm trying to ascertain is, would there be one of these specialists at every job site? If I'm a contractor and I'm doing 50 houses simultaneously, and I don't know your industry, so that may be way too many, but would I have to have 50 such experts, one at each job site, or could they get in the vehicle and travel from site to site?
Well, I'm sure that's I think the language of the bill was to have substantial oversight of the installation process. Pretty tough if you have 50 siding projects all going at the same time. It's going to be pretty tough for one individual to cover all 50 of those. Potentially, I could envision them covering three or four of them, I suppose. And oftentimes in a big project like that, they're not doing the siding on 50 houses at one time. They go a couple houses at a time and go down the project. That's, you know, left to CCB, I believe, in the bill to fine-tune that as what's practical. We didn't really want to micromanage exactly what constituted substantial oversight. I'm sure that a court of law may actually determine whether somebody had substantial oversight if, in fact, there was a product failure and they went back and they said, who was your certified specialist? And questioned him, well, did you see this getting installed this way, if it was installed correctly? And if he says, no, I wasn't there, then obviously he didn't have substantial oversight of it.
Mr. Chair,
follow up.
I like this bill. I like the direction that it's headed, but that's a concern to me, and I am worried that it will take litigation to define what substantial oversight is. Drive by in the truck 30 miles an hour and see the people are standing there, or actually get down underneath and see how stuff is actually attached to stuff.
Yeah.
And so that's my concern, and I don't know whether the anticipation is to try to set some sideboards on substantial oversight in WUL, or I just wasn't sure, and that's my biggest concern about the bill.
And we had a work group over that with industry itself, because previously we wanted them to actually be on the job while it's being installed, and we negotiated back to a substantial oversight to allow somebody to maybe do two houses at one time and jump back and forth, seeing that would happen. I think that the bottom line is if that product isn't being installed correctly, there isn't substantial oversight if somebody is trained how to do it.
And one other follow-up.
Some
products that we've read about have had sort of inherent manufacturing deficiencies, siding that grew mushrooms and stuff like that. Within the scope of professional practice for these specialists, would they be able to readily ascertain at the job site whether or not there were product manufacturer flaws in the material that was to be used?
Well, that's going to be tasked that to this advisory committee that's going to oversee the programs. Clearly, I mean, I think that's been one of the big problems for the industry. We've had such a large amount of new products on the market that people aren't familiar with or haven't really been tested, along with new codes that have come out with vapor barriers and things that have created some of these problems. That's why specifically I wanted to have or the committee decided to have an advisory group to overlook the different programs. So if we have somebody that's involved in installing siding that potentially could grow mushrooms, you know, that we have experts in that field that know how to prevent the mushrooms from happening. And so I think that advisory committee is extremely important, because it's made up of industry, it's made up of the building codes, construction board, people that are involved with the training programs, whether it's roofing or siding. They need to take a look at these programs and that are certifying or are going to be approved to certify the particular types of products that are being installed.
Thank you.
Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to try to wrap two questions into one for time purposes. Representative Holby, thanks for being here. Two questions. One with regards to the certification, and maybe you can enlighten us a little bit about the discussion in committee and that sort of thing. But with regards to the certification and the training that an installer or certified person is going to go through, is it going to be down to the point of, so for example, if they're learning to put on vinyl siding, that they learn that it has to be overlapped and then the notch has to be up and it's, you know, a certain setup and that sort of thing, or is it going to be more of a general overview? So that's one part of the question. The other part of the question is with regards to inspections. Does a bill contemplate that inspectors, building inspectors, when they're going out and they're looking to see that you know, things are done correctly as far as the outside of the structure is concerned? I mean, you can't look at a roof, for example, and see that the flashing has been installed correctly, or that the roof that the peak has been done correctly, without getting on a ladder, getting up there, and actually looking at it. Does this bill contemplate that inspectors are actually going to be trained and going to be doing that type of level of inspection, or is it going to be, you know, standing down on the ground and looking 45 feet in the air and saying, "Yep, by golly, it looks like that flashing's okay," and signing off on it? My concern is somebody's got to be responsible for when something is installed incorrectly. And if there's an oversight, particularly by a government official who is, you know, exempt from tort liability, how does that get resolved if the inspector has signed off on something?
Maybe you can. Well, that was a conversation that our committee did have, and as well as the work group did have, and I did have conversations with the building and officials, and you know, that's one a tough issue. And I think there's a misconception out there of what building inspectors really do out there and what they're able to do. There's reasons building inspectors don't get up on roofs. Just the liability issue of having an inspector crawling around on a roof is one thing with the OSHA requirements and all of that. But that's one of the reasons. I mean, ultimately, the contractor is the one that's responsible for this, you know, and the product of being constructed correctly. And so this bill is just aimed at making sure these contractors have somebody on their job site that's trained on how to do it right, basically. And ultimately, that person, you know, is identified, and we verify, because the CCB is going to keep track of who's certified for this building envelope installation process. And so that contractor's got to have one. And ultimately, that information has to be supplied to the building official in this bill. Some of this is going to be left up to rule, because we cannot micromanage every little piece of the real world. I mean, the professionals have to weigh in on this. Building officials don't have the ability to inspect whether the entire roof was nailed off correctly and whether the flashing was installed correctly. That's really a misconception on what their job really is. Clearly, it's going to be you know, important that this trained person knows what the codes are and knows that it's installed correctly. And you know, ultimately, the building official is going to have to give a certificate of occupancy, and hopefully, before they give a certificate of occupancy, they're going to make sure that building envelope specialist was on that job, you know, that somebody signed off and says he's not going to be personally liable for it. I don't think he can be. The contractor's liable for the project, but the building envelope specialist, you know, is going to have to be on that job, and we're going to have verification of that he was on that job during the installation process. That's the intent of this bill. It's really about training. It's really about making sure we have somebody on the job that's trained to do this.
Thank you. I think both Senator Bates, and I really want to get to Mr. Shiprock and
Mr. Berry and Mr. Miner, who had come back for the second day on this. But go ahead, please, Senator Bates.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to make an assumption that the Policy Commission did their job and got the questions we're answering already answered and have got the bill to the point that, from a policy point of view, it's ready to roll. That's the impression I'm getting from your testimony. My real question is, and since we are Ways and Means, we're not a Policy Commission, although that never stops us from going into policy. We are primarily a Ways and Means Committee. We need a physical impact statement. I need to know from the director of the CCB if he can absorb this program into his agency. That's the key question for me.
Senator, it's an interesting question in light of the fact, or an interesting point you bring up in light of the previous bill that we just moved out. At the present time, we do not have a fiscal impact statement on this bill.
And that's not my job. But
Representative, we did not pass the buck to you on that.
It's probably the 37 amendments that we had.
I just wanted you to know that
asked the question.
Mr. Chair, our committee did spend an incredible amount of time, and the agency spent an incredible amount of time trying to work through a policy that's going to help solve the problem. We think this is a very important piece. Hopefully the fiscal comes back, that it's not so huge that it's going to put it out of the reach of the state to get this implemented. I think this is incredibly important to the state of Oregon.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
And could the three gentlemen that I've indicated, please, and you are in luck. We started 7 minutes late, so we will start. We will finish 7 minutes late. That should give the members on the House side a chance to get to the floor before any of the other action begins. I don't know when the Senate is scheduled on the floor. So
10:15.
Okay,
I think.
You think. Good morning, gentlemen. And for the record, whoever wants to lead off.
I guess I was given the short straw. I'm Bob Shiprack, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building Trades Council, and I'm here this morning to lend strong support for this bill. This is a long time coming, and I'm going to keep my comments very brief. We've already started implementing this bill in my industry. I'm talking commercial construction. I actually had a test. There's a national company called Experior who does testing of craft individuals certification. I did this over at the Building Codes Agency last summer with four of my crafts. It took them about an hour and a half to take the test. It's a national test. It was graded, and they got their grades back. What we found in doing the test, however, was we thought there was some inadequacies, so I've got the industry folks, apprenticeship, and our contractors looking at putting together a better 50-question test is what this was. The roofing contractors, as we speak, are putting together a certification for roof systems. My glazers, those are the window guys, are already implementing a certification at their training centers now, trying to see how it is going to work. So we're moving forward with this. We just don't see, and the fact that the bill says that the industry itself can do the certification and do the qualifications really reduces the fiscal impact. And frankly, we would prefer it that way. We would want to see this done very well, and it's very important. So we're all for the bill. And I just wanted to close on one thing that why do I feel so strongly about this? This is a problem in this state, this intrusion of water. I'm a vice president of a community development corporation. We build affordable housing. There was a problem on one of our buildings. It wasn't the installer's fault. Everybody's getting sued. The attorney fees we're aware of right now are three times what it would cost to simply fix the building, and those are rising. I'm expecting to get personally sued any day now. My wife, who is the executive secretary of our community development corporation, which is now broke, is sending a letter to the Portland Development Commission to just hand over the keys to the building to them. We've had it. We can't do this. It's 3 years now. of litigation and no end in sight. And if this can help some people not have to go through the nightmare that we're going through, it's a good thing. And I wanted you to know what it's like out there when you, when these instances occur. It's terrible. Maybe it's something for Judiciary Committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. We support the basic premise that people that are on the job ought to have some skills and be trained. Our concern is the practical implications of this and the open-ended nature of the training obligations. Just to sort of set the stage, a person that installs a manufactured home already is licensed as a contractor, and another piece of legislation is going to have continuing education obligations. In addition to that, every person that installs a home has to have another license from the Building Codes Division. When they install the manufactured home, like a double section home, put it together, they're going to be touching the roof and the siding. So they're going to, just reading it, they're going to have now two more certifications. There's no, this, the discussion in the hallway actually is what's raising my concerns. We've seen this as possibly a day's training. We're now hearing, 2 to 4 days training. Really could be 2 to 4 months training. Testing, we haven't thought that was going to be a requirement, but it is. And when you look at people who do this type of work, you often find folks who have learning disabilities. Some of them aren't necessarily proficient in the language or they have issues there. So how will testing be done? Will it be proctored? Will folks read questions to those who have difficulty reading? How all that's going to work? Often our homes are installed in rural areas by folks who live in rural areas. How are they going to access this training? None that's spoken to here. In terms of inspections, I recognize the issues with OSHA, et cetera, but it'd be nice if inspectors actually inspected homes. I recognize that state is limited in its ability to enforce that. We have appreciated the working with Chairman Holby and Mr. Long. They've worked hard to meet our concerns. But again, it's the open-ended nature of this that raises our concern. So that'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you. Scott?
Good morning. Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association. And I think Bob sort of hit it on the head with his final comments about the litigation. Part of the reason this bill is before you and before the legislature is the litigation that the residential industry has faced, and understanding we weren't going to be able to change some of the other options in terms of lowering the statute of repose or doing some of the other things that may have helped us with some tort reform. We turned to the one thing we could control and said, well, what can we do? And I think what we could do is get our folks trained so that they understood how to properly install, and again, it's the building envelope where we saw most of the concerns, how to properly install and build the envelope of a home, and therefore potentially reduce that liability for our builders, because our liability insurance has literally skyrocketed, gone through the roof, and driven some folks out of business, frankly. To that end, we had a number of different bills. This is one of those. This focuses specifically on the certification of building envelope installers. And again, we, I think, are extremely supportive of the training of those building envelope individuals and making sure that there is some training on the job site. I think we believe that's critical. And much of that, I think, is done in this bill. Some of the concerns we have are probably the logistics. We've got 43,000 contractors with some new continuing education requirements that they're going to have to go through. 20,000 of those are also going to have to now do building envelope certification. That's the CCB estimate in terms of a number of folks that would have to meet this envelope certification piece. Logistically, that could be difficult. How we're going to go through that, is the contractor going to be able to get to the education? We're talking about folks in some cases in very small communities in eastern Oregon that may have to come in for 15 days of additional training because they do all of the construction on a home. And then in addition to that, have to take a test at the end that they may not pass all three sections of and have to come back and do some of that. So I think really the devil's in the details, and while we are 100% supportive of the education, how they get it, is there time to put it in place, is there going to be the resources, are the educators going to be out there at the end of the day, those are some of the concerns that we have, because believe me, that's when my phone starts ringing, and probably the agency's phone starts ringing as well, because here it comes this timeline for me to continue my practice, my trade, and I can't get access to all three types of education. Or I can get it, but I've got to travel to Portland for 2 or 3 weeks to do it. That's the kind of stuff that is going to cause our phone to start ringing, and we just want to make sure it's working. The only other point I will make is I believe the advisory committee set up in this bill potentially creates another problem. We've had some long discussions through the task force. We've had long discussions in the legislature, and I'm not sure with the makeup of the task force or the advisory committee, we're not going to have more long discussions in there about just exactly what all this should look like. So, coming, I guess, from the group of folks that, in terms of numbers, are going to have to go through this stuff, we have some issues again with those logistics and that piece of it. So, I'll end my comments there. Again, the training and the continuing ed in 2654. Are a must for our industry, we believe.
Thank you very much, Scott. I appreciate all of your comments and testimony. Is there any quick questions? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing here just momentarily, but I'm going to note for the members that it is my opinion that there are some amendments floating around out there someplace, and I am going to make the assumption that those amendments are delivered forthwith to the committee staff so that they can be distributed to the members, so we have some idea of what it is that we might be looking at before we're ever put in a position of having to take any kind of action on it. So with that, we will close the public hearing on Assembly 2656, and thus we are adjourned.